Would you open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 25, verse 1. Deep down, the world knows that an end is coming. In his daily briefing podcast, Dr. Albert Mohler recently said this. He said, human beings made in the image of God have to know, have to have a sense that, have to have an instinct to look towards some catastrophic end to the world as we know it. He says, there is some kind of judgment coming, and we know it. And that is something, he says, that is so deeply ingrained in the human consciousness that it comes out in the bulletin of the atomic scientist. What is he talking about? What Dr. Mohler is referring to is a headline that appeared just a matter of weeks ago in the pages of USA Today. Doomsday clock stays near catastrophe, was the headline. The doomsday clock was a design intended to be a metaphoric way of speaking about how close a group of scientists felt humanity was coming to the apocalypse, to the dramatic, violent end of the world. More specifically, it was a way of speaking about how close they felt we were coming to the threat of destroying ourselves by means of thermonuclear weapons. The idea for this clock was first introduced back to the public back in 1947, not long after the end of World War II. Having witnessed the devastating power of nuclear weapons and foreseeing, you know, an escalation in the power, production, and proliferation of such weapons, these scientists came out and they announced that they were setting their so-called doomsday clock to 90 seconds before midnight, with midnight standing for annihilation. And so the headline in recent days, doomsday clock stays near catastrophe, that headline shows us that people are still thinking about this coming catastrophe, this coming apocalypse, even 77 years after that clock was first set, and even though many of the threats to humanity have since changed. But I think we see this consciousness of coming judgment in other ways too. Maybe you've seen it too. Just think of all the end of the world movies and shows that are out there. A recent article in Forbes magazine asked this question: want to know what's on the minds of Americans and others around the world? Just study what they're watching. Netflix recently released its first ever biannual viewing report, which gives insights into what people across the globe are craving on their screens, the article said. And it says this: one trend that is unmistakable is viewer obsession with apocalyptic survival. It's interesting. You know, speaking of survival, there's not just an appetite for watching those kinds of shows. There's also a growing social movement that stresses personally learning techniques for survival yourself, right? All sorts of courses that offer training and proactive preparation for emergency situations. Maybe some of you have been involved in some of those things. And so be prepared isn't just the scout motto anymore. Now it's a lifestyle. In a recent survey, roughly one-third of the U.S. adult population now identifies as preppers. So, you know, where is all this end time angst coming from? Albert Mohler concluded his story about the doomsday clock this way. He says, but of course, this instinct of coming judgment doesn't just come out in the bulletin of the atomic scientists. It also comes out authoritatively in the Holy Scriptures, where we are warned indeed that there will be an apocalypse. We are warned that there is judgment coming. This sense of impending doom, I think, is coming both from an inner awareness of what our sin deserves as beings who are made in the image of God. I don't think we can escape that sense. And, as Dr. Mohler says, from a corresponding awareness of what God has warned us about in the Bible when it comes to judgment. Now, asked Dr. Mohler, where are we on that doomsday clock? Speaking of the Bible's timeline, we might ask his question another way. How close are we to midnight? The last time we were together in Matthew's gospel, we had just finished studying the end of chapter 24. There, Jesus had begun to answer the question the disciples had asked about when his future final coming would be, what we call his second coming, his parousia. And his answer can be summed up in two words, unknown and unawares. Jesus tells them his future and final return will come at a time no one knows except God the Father, and Jesus tells them his future and final return will come at a time that will catch people unawares. He then goes on to give them three illustrations about the sudden unexpectedness of this future and final coming. First, he gave an illustration from history, if you remember, pointing to how the people in Noah's time were caught completely by surprise at the coming of the great flood on a day just like any other day. Second, he gave an illustration from everyday life. It was a picture of two men doing a normal day's work in a field, and it was a picture of two women doing a normal day's work, grinding wheat into flour. There was nothing outwardly distinguishing them or that distinguished the day that they were working on from any other day, and yet suddenly Jesus said, of the men in the field, one is taken and one is left. The same thing happened to the women. Suddenly and without warning, one is taken and one is left. Such would be the sudden unexpectedness of his coming, Jesus said. His third illustration of this sudden unexpectedness came in the form of a mini parable. In it, Jesus compared himself to a thief, and he compared us to homeowners who never know when a thief is going to break in, right? After all, if we did know, no thief would catch us unawares because we'd wait up for him. But Christ's point is that we don't know when he's coming. Like a thief, he'll come when we least expect it. And so the conclusion of all three illustrations was the same. Jesus said his disciples are to be ready. If you are a disciple of Jesus Christ, you are to be ready. Be ready. But the question is really how, right? How are we to be ready? What does it mean to be ready? What does that look like? Well, we said last time that doesn't look like my dog sitting at the window doing nothing, waiting for my truck to show up, right? That's not the kind of waiting. That's not the kind of ready it's supposed to be. We said last time Jesus lays out three concrete, proactive, practical ways to be ready. And so at the end of chapter 24, we looked at the first way, presented through a parable about a faithful steward and a wicked steward. And we saw in that parable that the first way to be ready is to be faithful in feeding and caring for Christ's people while he's away. If we're truly disciples of Jesus, this is the expected result for one of his own when he comes, that we'll be found ready. We'll be found doing the job we were entrusted to do. And we said this first way to be ready was really directed especially, but not exclusively, at the leaders of the church and at the leaders of the family. And now today in chapter 25, we're going to look at the second of those three ways that Jesus says we're to be ready, that you're to be ready. This second way is to be faithful in preparing your heart for his coming. And this second way is presented to us in the form of a parable about 10 virgins. Look with me now at verse 1 of that parable. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Our parable starts with the word then. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins. That then is a reference back to the unexpected day and hour of Christ's return. At the time of his return, then, on that day and hour, the kingdom of heaven will be experienced the way these 10 virgins are said to experience the delayed but sudden arrival of a bridegroom. On that day, something analogous to this story will happen to the church. Now, weddings were one of the high points of village life in ancient Israel. You know, at a time when entertainment was far less accessible and food and drink were far less plentiful. Weddings are, you know, they were the, it was like the Super Bowl parties of antiquity, right? You wanted to make sure you were invited to one. You wanted to make sure you were included in one. But Jewish wedding customs at the time of Jesus, you know, they're not as well understood as we wish they were. You know, as I looked through about 7 different commentaries this week, that was the universal admission of all of them. We don't know as much about Jewish weddings as we wish we did, but we do know some basics. For instance, we know that the formal wedding ceremony, which usually took place about a year after betrothal, included a special procession by the groom and his companions to the bride's home. So the bridegroom would symbolically leave his parents' home, where he'd grown up. He would head for his bride's home, where she lived with her parents, and then he would escort her and her companions to his own home that he had made, where a great wedding feast would then be held. Sometimes the wedding was also held at the bride's home. Well, if a wedding was one of the high points of village life, that wedding feast was the high point of the wedding celebration itself. It's what everyone looked forward to. And so the questions we're asking as we read this story, as we read this parable, are first, you know, who are these women mentioned in this first verse of our text? And second, what role do they actually play in these festivities? Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Well, these virgins seem to represent the companions of the bride, right? They're part of the bridal party, or what we might today call the bridesmaids. Even though the bride herself is nowhere mentioned in this parable, these 10 virgins seem to represent her entourage. These are her companions. Now, there are some who are really bothered by this parable. They're really bothered at this point because they wonder why this isn't a parable about the bride herself. After all, they say, you know, if this is a parable about waiting for Christ the bridegroom to come for his church in order to take us to the great marriage feast of the Lamb, which, by the way, is pretty much what everybody agrees this parable is about, if that's the case, then why doesn't the parable portray the church as the bride? You know, why the bridesmaids instead? Well, I don't think we need to overanalyze that particular distinction here. And the main reason, I think, is because if this was a parable about a singular bride, it wouldn't be able to communicate the contrast that Jesus is really wanting to make just a few moments from now. Okay, and so about some who are ready and some who are not. It would be really hard to make that distinction if it was just about a singular bride. Besides, as members of the wedding party, you need to remember that these 10 virgins will have to wait to meet up with the bridegroom in exactly the same way that the bride has to wait. And so I don't think it takes anything away from the parable at all to make these 10 virgins represent the church waiting for the arrival of Jesus. Because the main point of being ready to meet him applies to them in exactly the same way that it would apply to the bride. Does that make sense? Okay, so we don't need to get confused or upset about that. And so here they are at the bride's house, waiting to meet the bridegroom. And Jesus says they took something with them when they went to wait there to meet the groom. What did they take? They took lamps. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom, he says. What are these lamps? Well, they're not the typical kind of domestic lights that were used indoors at this time. They weren't, you know, the little clay containers of oil with a wick that were normally lit and put on a high stand inside a house, like Jesus talked about back in Matthew chapter 5, when he called his disciples the light of the world. The word used here is different from that word. It's the same word, in fact, that's used for what the arresting party is carrying when Judas leads them to Jesus only days from now in the Garden of Gethsemane. And so it seems to refer to a sort of lamp that's mounted on the end of a stick, or even more basically, some kind of torch, right? A stick with oil-soaked cloth at the top, something for outdoor use, okay? Once lit, these kinds of torches would usually burn brightly for between 15 and 20 minutes, 15 and 30 minutes even, before going out, and then they would sort of need to be dipped or re-soaked in oil and relit. That's how these functioned. And so the text says, all 10 virgins have taken these torches for the meeting with the bridegroom. All right, so far, so good. But then we get to verse 2. Five of them were foolish, Jesus says of these virgins, and five were wise. You know, I think you should notice that up to this point, there has been nothing to distinguish between these 10 women. Externally, they all appear exactly the same. Outwardly, they've all shared these similarities. They're all virgins. So, in other words, they all tend to share the appearance of innocence and external virtue in the eyes of men. Second, all of them have lamps, and they're all the same kind of lamps. And finally, number three, all of these virgins are said to be waiting for the bridegroom. They're all there to perform the same role. But now Jesus tells us that despite all of those similarities so far, they're not actually the same at all, these 10 women. He says that in fact, half of them are different in this way. They're foolish. They're foolish. The word in Greek here is moros, from which we get our word for, anyone? Moron. It's a word that literally means dull or stupid. It's a word that describes a person who consistently acts moronically. It sounds a little harsh. Commentator W.E. Vine says, it's a word that scorns a person's heart and character. Now, there are some versions that try to soften this up because I think they feel this is a little harsh, this is a little rude, and so they translate these as the five silly virgins. They're just silly. But we might as well translate it correctly, says Pastor R.C. Sproul. Five of these virgins were stupid. Well, how in the world does someone like Jesus, who's so loving and meek and mild, how in the world does Jesus justify such a sudden and harsh-sounding distinction? What is it that makes half of these virgins, in his judgment, foolish or stupid? This is why, he tells us now in verse 3. For, because when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. When I lived in Weaverville, I had the coolest truck in the world. It's the coolest truck in the world. It was a black with red and gray pinstripe, four-wheel drive, single cab, 1986 Ford F-150 Lariat. It was a thing of beauty. And the gas gauge did not work, which always made things very exciting. And so, since I'm a bit absent-minded, if you know me, at some point I decided it would probably be a good idea to carry a spare gas can in the back of the truck. But you know what? You know what? That can doesn't do you any good if you forget to fill it, which was the lesson I had to learn, I'm sad to say, more than once. So that by the end, I always actually carried two gas cans in the back of that truck. I called the first can my emergency can, and I called the second one my idiot can. So, as bad as that was, it seems that here in our parable, something even more idiotic than that is going on. Because it's not just that these five virgins forget to bring spare oil. It's not just that they forget to bring extra oil. The text says they took no oil with them. Here they are, and they've come during the daylight hours to the bride's house, and they've brought along their torches because they know full well the celebration and the procession with the groom will take place sometime after dark. They know this. This is not something new. So they bring their torches along with them, and yet five of these virgins bring their torches with no fuel at all for them. They took no oil with them. Now, I think there's probably still some of you out there who are thinking to yourselves that it's not very nice for Jesus to call someone stupid. But friends, here's the justification he gives for such a judgment. These people have taken flashlights for a night hike without bringing any batteries. What would you call them? Finally, here's some good news, though. We got some good news, because it turns out that not all of them are foolish virgins. Look now at verse 4. But the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps, Jesus says. But in this sentence is a word that pivots us in a new direction, right? In this case, that word but pivots us away from discouraging foolishness and pivots us instead into a direction that hints at hope. There are foolish or stupid virgins, yes, but there are also wise or sensible virgins. And the only thing Jesus says that distinguishes one from the other is that the wise virgins took oil with them for their lamps. That's it. Jesus says the five wise virgins took flasks of oil. These were some sort of vessel. They were a jar or a pail used for storing the oil. If they carried a lamp on a stick, that oil could be poured from this jar into the lamp, into the basin of that lamp to sustain the flame and refill it if necessary. If what they carried was more like a torch, the rags on the end of the stick could be dipped into the pail and relit when needed. In other words, this second group of virgins didn't just take their flashlights with them. They also took batteries and maybe even spare batteries. Well, how will this difference affect the outcome? Well, you know, at first, as we read here, as we go on to verse 5, this difference between the virgins doesn't seem to affect anything at first, right? Outwardly, at first, they still look the same and they experience the same things. Look with me now at verse 5. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept, right? It's not just the foolish virgins who became drowsy and slept. They all became drowsy and slept. Here in a scene utterly foreign to all American males, the women are waiting on a man so they can go somewhere. This is astounding. No one's ever heard of such a thing. And yet as they wait at the house of the bride, as they wait there, there's plenty of borrowed light at the house of the bride. The domestic lamps of the house, they provide light for them while they wait. And so there's nothing yet to bring out the differences between these virgins that we've already been made aware of. We know there's differences, but there's nothing yet that is showing that difference. Likewise, there appears to be no difference between them yet when it comes to the effects of that disappointingly long wait for the bridegroom, because we're told they all eventually fall asleep. Both the foolish ones and the wise ones alike. They all became drowsy and slept. First, they became drowsy. You know, it's a description of the initial stage of sleep where your eyes are growing heavy and your head starts nodding even though you're fighting it. It's like the college class where no matter how often you look at that clock, the hands always seem stuck in the same place and you wonder how much more you can take. And so finally, their heads get lower and lower until they drop down completely, and all 10 drop off into an ongoing state of sleep. And since all the virgins fall asleep, there doesn't seem to be anything about this sleep itself that's being presented to us as something sinful or bad in the case of this parable. Now, have you ever had an alarm clock that made you panic when it went off in the morning? Yeah, I see some heads nodding. When I was at boarding school in high school, I had this big old clock, and it had two actual metal bells. Do they make those anymore? That's like a health hazard on the top, these two large bells. And between the two bells, there was a yellow metal chicken. It was a fantastic design, and it would go back and forth between those two bells. It would peck back and forth furiously when that alarm went off. And I tell you, I would wake up about a foot above my bed in a cold sweat It was the most terrifying thing. I was sure I was either dying or I was late for school, and I wasn't sure which was worse. It wouldn't have been more shocking if someone had, you know, woken me up with a bucket of ice water. And so I'd fumble and I'd thrash around to shut that thing off before it woke up the whole dorm, because it was that loud. Well, something about the wake-up call we now find in verse 6 reminds me of that alarm clock. It's unsettling. It's startling to be woken from a dead sleep by a shout, by a sudden and great clamor. But at midnight, there was a cry. Here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. You know, suddenly the hands of the clock aren't stuck anymore. Suddenly, in the blink of an eye, it's midnight. Groggy eyes snap open. Adrenaline surges. Minds struggle to orient themselves, and hands fumble into function. You know, where am I? What's going on? Oh, yes, the bridegroom has come. Where's my torch? There it is. Hurry, we gotta go. It's time to go. A great and decisive change was the result of the cry, writes Marvin Vincent. No more sleeping, no more waiting, no more silence. There is a cry, and behold the awaking, the bustle, the trimming of lamps. Look now at verse 7. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. That just means, let's just dumb it down. That just means they got their torches ready to use. That's what that means, okay? That means they prepared to light those lamps, those torches, so they could go out into the darkness. And suddenly, unexpectedly, the reality of their predicament comes crashing down on the five foolish virgins. Look with me at verse 8. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. What's happening? What's happening here? What's happening is that the five foolish virgins are trying desperately to light those rags at the top of their torch. They're trying to light that wick, and it won't stay lit because they have no oil. They have no fuel. Well, that's an easy fix, say the foolish virgins. Just give us some of your oil. Share with us. Having suddenly realized their own stupidity and need, they also finally recognize the great sense the other five virgins have had all along. And now they appeal to them. How do the wise virgins respond? Look at verse 9. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. The wise virgins respond by telling them they must go get their own oil. And their refusal here, this is a really firm one. It doesn't necessarily come out in all the translations. Once again, we find in their response, in the original language, the double negative in Greek that doesn't turn into a positive, like in English. You know, when we have a double negative, it becomes a positive. Instead, it reinforces the negative when it's in Greek. In other words, they actually say something closer to, never. There will certainly not be enough for us in you. Or as Alfred Edersheim renders it, not at all. It will never suffice for us in you. Or as R.T. France translates it, no way. There would never be enough for us and for you. Now, before you start to wonder if that was the kind and loving thing for them to do, remember first that they're not the ones Jesus calls foolish in this parable. It's not the actions of the wise virgins that Jesus is calling out here. It's the actions of the foolish ones. But second, remember that in a parable, as France puts it, things don't always happen according to real life. Okay? So while in real life, I'm sure that these girls would almost certainly have shared some of their oil as much as they reasonably could, the spiritual point being made about this oil seems to be that whatever it represents, it's not something you can borrow from another person. And so you have to go get your own oil, the wise virgins say. Go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. Well, there were only two problems with this advice. Only two problems. You know, one of the most frustrating things when Esther and I first moved back from New York to Reading was how early everything closes here. For 3.5 years, we lived 20 minutes from the third largest mall in America, which at that time was a 5-story behemoth that was open 7 days a week until 10 o'clock at night, every day. And then suddenly we were back in Reading, where the only mall in town shuts down by 6 p.m. on Sundays. I'm still not used to it. The other day, my sons and I had to hunt down a salesperson to let us out of JCPenney because it closed while we were in there. We got locked in. We're like, let us out. And so I'll give you one guess what the first problem was for those foolish virgins who rushed off to buy oil from the dealers at that hour. I'll give you one guess. No dealers are likely awake, much less open at midnight. No, that ship has sailed, right? Going to find oil now is like the student starting to study for a test as it's being passed out. It's like me rushing across town this week to buy a pump after my porch was already flooding with water. A little too late. And now the second problem shows up in verse 10. Look with me there. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Look, even if by some miracle a dealer's shop is open, it's too late now on this end because this door is closed. They may be open, but now this door is closed. The foolish virgins are leaving even as the bridegroom is coming. They failed to fulfill their role. They're missing out on the entrance to the high point of life. It's only those ones who are ready, the 5 virgins who took oil, who now go out to meet the bridegroom and then go back with him into the feast. Those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, Jesus says. It's the same word for ready he's just used a few moments ago in Matthew chapter 24, verse 44. He says there, "Therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Look now at the tragic scene that plays out in verse 11. "Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.'" You know, they're outside in the dark while inside the great feast is in full swing. They're outside in the dark because the door was shut. And I say they're outside in the dark because the text doesn't say they actually succeeded in finding oil. The text doesn't say any dealers were still open or awake. The text just says they came back later and tried to get into the feast. It's tragic. But the door was shut, Jesus says. You know, as firmly as the door of Noah's Ark, the door to the marriage feast is shut. And so they can't get in. Instead, the distinction and the separation between them and the other virgins has now been made suddenly, concretely, permanently, literally clear. The wise virgins are the insiders, and the foolish virgins are the outsiders. "Lord, Lord, open to us," they say to the bridegroom. Listen now to this chilling response in verse 12 from inside the door. And I think made all the more chilling because it's Jesus himself who is ultimately the bridegroom. And he's the one saying these words. "But he answered, 'Truly I say to you, I do not know you.'" Can you imagine hearing those words from Jesus? "I do not know you." They're words that one commentator calls a formula of disassociation. They're words that remind me of what Peter will say about Jesus when he denies him only a few days from now. "I do not know the man." In that moment, he uses some of the strongest language he can think of to deflect any relationship or any association with Jesus. And now that's the same sense we have here. "I have no relationship or association with you." What are we to make of this parable? how are we to interpret its main point? You know, I think these last two verses really give us all the clues that we need. When was the last time we read about someone crying out, "Lord, Lord," to Jesus in this way? It was back in Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 23, and I believe this ending is meant to draw our thoughts back to that scene and the words of Jesus there. "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven," Jesus said there, "but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.'" What are we to make of this parable? How are we to interpret its main point? I said at the start of the message today that Jesus is laying out practical ways for his disciples to be ready for his unexpected return. The first way to be ready is to be faithful in feeding and caring for Christ's people while he's away. If we're truly his, that's what we'll naturally be doing when he comes. We'll be found ready doing the job we were entrusted to do. We talked about that in our last sermon together in Matthew's gospel. And we said that was directed mostly towards leaders in the church and leaders in the family. But now this second way to be ready, this second way is directed at everyone in the church who calls themselves a disciple. To everyone in the church who calls themselves a Christian. And it's this: be faithful in preparing your heart for his coming. What does that mean? Well, it means that one day, on the day Christ returns, something analogous to the story about the virgins will happen to the church. Friends, Jesus has made it clear all throughout Matthew's gospel that there are many who call themselves Christians who are not really Christians. That there are always counterfeit Christians, that there are always bogus believers, that there are always tares among the wheat and foolish virgins mixed into every congregation. And you know what the tricky thing is? You know what the tricky thing about tares and foolish virgins is? It's that outwardly they look and act the same as the wheat and the wise up until the very end. But at that point, it's too late to change, you know, at the end. At that point, it's too late. And so Jesus is addressing that reality with this parable to warn the foolish and the fakes in the church to prepare while there's still time, while there's still daylight, because midnight is coming. And that final movement of the hands of that clock will either set off the worst alarm you've ever heard, or it will set ringing the sweetest bells imaginable. It will either be the signal of the opening of a door to you, or it will be the signal of the shutting of one. It will either distinguish you permanently as an outsider, or it will welcome you warmly as an insider. And so the first way you must prepare your heart is by trusting Christ for your salvation. Maybe you've gone to a church for years where to be a Christian just meant showing up regularly on Sunday mornings. You know, the bar was set kind of low. You know, that was what it meant to be a Christian. It just meant you had to dress up a little nicer and put money in the plate. It just meant you sang the songs and you did your best not to fall asleep and listen respectfully to the preacher. It meant that you did your best, like everyone else, to stop cursing, stop drinking, to stop cheating, whatever else was added to the list each week after week after week. It just meant you did your best to be a good person, and you hoped you'd done enough. Maybe you've come to believe being a Christian means just being involved in social causes. You know, you think you're a Christian because you feed the poor, you care for the sick, you look out for orphans and widows, you visit people in prison. Maybe you've come to believe that it means loving people by affirming them no matter what and never making judgments. Maybe that's what you do, and so you call yourself a Christian. You know, you think being a Christian means actions, not words. It means doing, not doctrine. Maybe you've grown up in a church all your life and you thought to be a Christian just meant being part of a Christian family. You know, your mom and dad are Christians, so you just sort of always assumed you were one too. It's like genetic, right? You just inherit the thing. You got baptized, you became a member of a church because that's what your parents did and that's what Christians do, and you were part of a Christian family. It's possible you figured it worked like a family phone plan or an insurance plan, you know? Your parents were the ones paying the bills for you. You just took advantage of it. Maybe you grew up believing the saints were the ones looking out for you. They helped you out. You know, so your trust was really in a human priest and in the church. For you, being a Christian meant a list of ceremonies and rituals that if you were faithful to check these things off regularly, you know, you'd be okay. As long as you paid God his dues, he'd leave you alone. And if you got into a jam or you messed up too badly, well, it's all right. You could always get an extra list of things to do and it could make up for those sins and you were good. Maybe for you to be a Christian always meant having emotional experiences. It was all about being moved by music and stories and looking for miracles and focusing on positivity. Describing such people, one commentator says, repentance and faith and grace and holiness are mere words and names to them. They are subjects which they either dislike or about which they feel no concern. The thing is, there are some elements of truth in all of these understandings of what it means to be a Christian. There's lots of borrowed light in the house of the bride. In other words, many people are able to go a long time passing as Christians simply by sticking close to the traditions of the church and simply by sticking close to other Christians. You know, you can walk behind someone with a flashlight and still see for a while. But in the end, the question will always come down to this. Do you have the oil the wise virgins had? You yourself. A pastor friend of mine who preached on this parable asks the obvious question, and then he answers it in a way I don't think I can improve on. He says this, what is the oil? What is the oil? Well, he says, what's the one thing you've got to have to get into the great feast? Well, there you go. What's the one thing you've got to have to get into the great feast that you can't get from your parents, that you can't get from your friends, you can't get from anyone else? You've got to have it yourself. Trust in Jesus, he says. And the only way you do that is if the Holy Spirit changes your heart. Trust in Jesus, he says. That's the oil. That's the oil. Friend, have you trusted in Jesus? Have you trusted in Jesus? A man cannot borrow a relationship with God, writes William Barclay. He must possess it for himself. Have you trusted in Jesus? Saving grace, it is here taught, is a personal possession, writes R.V.G. Tasker, and it is non-transferable. When the final day of salvation comes, none can deliver his brother. Have you trusted in Jesus? No one can get into the kingdom of God on the coattails of one with genuine faith, writes R.C. Sproul. Everyone must come on his own. He cannot rely on his father's faith, his mother's faith, his wife's faith, or anyone else's faith. Have you trusted in Jesus? In this present state of grace, writes A. Lucan Williams, we have the comforting injunction, knock and it shall be opened unto you. In the day of retribution, the door is shut and no knocking will unclose its barred portal. Friend, have you trusted in Jesus? Have you thought about the unpleasant words like sin and hell in connection with yourself and realized both are yours without him? Listen, to be a Christian doesn't mean to do your best. It means to trust in Jesus. He's the best. He's the best of us. He did perfectly everything that God demands of you. To be a Christian is to admit that even your best will never be enough. Never. That torch won't light. Because your sin is too great. Even one sin is too great to escape the judgment of a holy God. that torch won't light. There's no amount of penance. There's no amount of prayers to the saints. There's no amount of money in the offering plate. There's no amount of years spent in purgatory that could ever make up for what you've done. And so the best you have to offer God is like filthy rags. Or in this case, like the rags of a torch with no oil. That torch won't light. It won't light. No, you need the person and work of Jesus. And if you trust him, you have him. He gives you himself. He gives you his own righteous record. And he gives you himself. He gives you his own body and blood to pay for your sin once and for all on a cross. So that to be a Christian is to have the Spirit of Christ ever with you and in you, and the forgiveness of God ever upon you. To be a Christian is to become united to Christ by trusting what he did, by living and dying and rising again, and believing that he did it for you, and that it was enough to please God. Jesus is the only oil that can bring healing and peace with God, and Jesus is the only oil that can produce new life in you and lasting light. If you've got that, my pastor friend says, if you've got him, then that sin of yours was nailed to the cross of Christ when the sun went dark and the moon and stars gave no light. His death was your judgment. He has covered your sin, and you are washed in his blood. If you've got him, you've got the oil. Look with me now at verse 13. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor hour. What does Jesus mean by this command to watch? Is this sort of a backhand, disapproving reference to the falling asleep of all 10 virgins? Well, I don't think so. As I said earlier, I don't think sleeping itself in this parable is being called out as something that was wrong. I think the sleep of the virgins here just represents something natural to all people. I think it is a reference to being occupied with the everyday cares of life. This is a natural thing. The problem is that there's a difference between what is natural for the Christian and what is natural for the non-Christian. What's natural for the Christian is to be unconsciously preoccupied with God's kingdom work, even as they go about their daily activities and tend to a variety of cares. We'll see this come out in a few weeks in the account of the final judgment near the end of chapter 25. But what's natural for the one without Christ, what's natural for that person is not the same thing. What's natural for that person is a preoccupation with looking out for himself and the building of his own kingdom. It's a preoccupation with things that can quickly choke out and obscure any thought of the need for oil and of that coming midnight. And so instead, I think Christ's command here to watch means we're to prepare our hearts by trusting in Christ the moment we are presented with that opportunity. And before those everyday cares can return to distract us to death. There is an urgency here. The first way you prepare your heart for Christ's coming is by trusting Christ for your salvation. And now the second way you prepare your heart for his coming is by trusting him now before the cares of this life can distract you. Or as I have it in the notes, prepare your heart for Christ's coming by taking Christ into your sleep. And so watch, therefore, doesn't mean don't fall asleep like all 10 virgins did. It means be ready. It means prepare yourself today before midnight comes. Better yet, it means prepare yourself today even before Monday comes. Before Monday comes, before this temporary alertness you've been granted this morning wears off and you nod back off to sleep. Because if that happens Before you put your trust in Jesus this morning, there are no guarantees that you will wake up before midnight. If you keep putting it off, if you don't do it now, if you don't put your trust in Christ now, you're going to keep putting it off till tomorrow and the next day until there are no more tomorrows left, until one day, the day and hour of his return will come and will catch you unprepared. Until one day, in the twinkling of an eye, it'll suddenly be midnight and your foolishness will be laid bare. Almost 170 years ago, Pastor J.C. Ryle wrote this about the sleeping world Christ will find when he returns. Business will be going on in town and country just as it does now. Politics, trades, farming, buying, selling, pleasure seeking will be taking up men's attention just as they do now. Rich men will still be faring sumptuously and poor men murmuring and complaining. Ministers will still be calling men to repent, and the vast majority in all congregations will be still putting off the day of decision. In the midst of all this, he says, the Lord Jesus himself shall suddenly appear. In an hour when no man thinketh, the startled world shall be summoned to break off all its employments and to stand before its lawful king. Friends, the good news for you without Jesus today is this. That day and hour has not yet come. It is not yet midnight. That is the good news for you. It's not yet too late to go to the dealer for oil. And look, you've made it this far. Look at God and his kindness, where he has brought you. He has brought you to the very store you need. He has brought you here in this hour to this store. And look, we're still open. We're still open. So let the one who wishes to buy oil do so now before the bridegroom comes. Do it now. Maybe you say, I've got no money. I've got no money. You say you've got no goodness sufficient to buy what you need. You say you've loved too little. You've failed too much. You've betrayed too many. You've helped too few. You say, I can't buy it. I'm bankrupt. I'm bad. I'm broken. Well, then come. Let the one who desires come and buy without money. Come and buy without payment, because Jesus paid it all. He paid it all. Jesus has paid it all. Just trust him and you will have it all. Just trust in him and you will be saved. You'll be saved. Finally, now let me add this. Watch, therefore, isn't just a warning for the foolish. It's also a promise for the wise. For the Christian, it means look forward to this day. Yes, that closed door does mean judgment for the unbeliever on the other side, but that closed door also means wonderful things for those who are on the inside. When Jesus comes, writes J.C. Ryle, the door shall be shut at last. Shut on all pain and sorrow. Shut on all ill-natured and wicked. Shut on a tempting devil. Shut on all doubts and fears. Shut to be opened again no more. When he comes, concludes my pastor friend, that battle between the old you and the you of the new creation will be over forever. That old bitterness and lust and greed and selfishness, all that darkness that you hate about yourself, that great burden will be gone forever. His coming will be freedom for you and everlasting joy. Watch then. Trust in Jesus and his promises to you. Cling to them in the evening and at midnight and in the morning.